accession number 9304, Reel 2.
Admiral Salter, Reel 2. So, you were saying that you got this entertainment from the Russians. Was there any other form of fraternization?
No, I don't think there was. But that actual part was all very friendly. I can't remember what, if one fed them and that sort of thing, but I think we probably did.
Could you see anything of the Russian military strength at Murmansk?
No. Absolutely none. A bit later on, I had experience of the hospital, which I'll tell you shortly. But Russian military strength or naval strength, no, neither. There was none of it visible at all.
What about the way in which they unloaded the cargoes? How was that done? Was it done efficiently or not?
I regret to say I don't know. I haven't the slightest idea. I suppose it was. They didn't do it within our range of sight, I think. I imagine I heard no complaints about inefficient unloading at all. And I imagine it was all right. Well, ought to have been, of course, because we gave them a hell of a lot.
Do you know what kind of cargoes the convoy had taken?
I can't tell you precisely, but I mean, we were sending ammunition and tanks and all that sort of thing. They're all munitions of war of various sorts, some in vehicles and some in armaments. But I don't really know, no.
Any food?
Don't think so.
How long approximately were you there?
About 10 days, I think.
Was any cargo loaded to ship back to Britain?
I think not. Well, except, as a matter of fact, in the Edinburgh, a lot of gold was loaded, which you know all about, probably. But actual cargo, I don't think it was.
This is the famous gold that was recently retrieved.
Exactly, yes. Yes, well, not all of it, actually. Quite. Retrieved.
No. Whilst you're at Murmansk, were there any German attacks?
We had a certain number of aircraft attacks. They were always liable to come. And we were always on the qui vive for them. If they did come, they were usually isolated aircraft and they'd drop one or two bombs. They were a nuisance, that's all, really. And, as I say, we were always ready for them because it was daylight all the time.
Whilst you were in Russia, did you get any sense of the suffering that they were going through?
No.
Or deprivations?
No.
Now, presumably you hadn't lost any ships on the way into Russia, on the convoy?
I couldn't tell you that without looking it up, but I think the answer is we had. But it wasn't very many. I think we had a ship bombed and sunk, but as I say, my memory of that is a bit woolly.
Now, can you tell me what happened on the convoy back, the QP-11?
Yes. We started off at about pretty early in the morning. As soon as we went out, we began to be shadowed by a Focke Wulf. By the evening, there were, I think, 8 going round. So we knew perfectly well that we were in for it. And at that time we had to look out for, we'd gone right up to the ice edge, so that if we went any further north we should run into ice. We had U-boats, we knew, round about, and we were attacked by 2 lots, I think it was, of 12 torpedo bombers. They were I forget what they were called now, German ones, anyhow. And, well, that passed off all right. And we came to the night, which, of course, was broad daylight. And then the next day, we heard that the Edinburgh, which was exercising distant cover to the convoy, had been torpedoed. The thing was normally that one had a close escort, which was destroyers and things. I was one of them. And we had one cruiser, which took on any larger ships that came along. And this cruiser was the Edinburgh. She started off by being in the middle of the convoy, where she'd be more or less protected from torpedoes. And then she went off on her own at fairly high speed, getting about 20 miles or so from the convoy. She was torpedoed during that time, and I was sent off in the Foresight with another, the only other fleet destroyer, the Forester, to look after the Edinburgh. When we got to her, we found that she was in a very poor state. She'd been hit right aft with two torpedoes. The upper deck was peeled back. I don't know if you've ever seen a scorpion, but when a scorpion wants to sting you, it flings its tail up. And really, she looked just like a scorpion trying to attack, because the whole of the quarterdeck was peeled back. She lost both her inner propeller shafts and her rudder. And so all she'd got to steer with was her two... she'd got four shafts, you see, four engines. And all she got to steer with was her two propeller shafts, one each side. And it was not very effective. So then we tried all sorts of measures to get her going straight. The object was to get her back to Murmansk. And we were something like 200 miles out, I think, then. We tried, first of all, towing her. But that was no good. And then we tried... I was taken in tow by the Edinburgh. And if she tried to steer herself with her engines, if she sheared in one direction, which she perpetually did, if she sheared off to starboard, for instance, I myself, which was not working my engines, I was being towed simply, I sheared to starboard, and that pulled her stern back. That was the idea. And we managed to get along after a fashion like that, but it wasn't very good. Forrester was acting as anti-submarine escort ahead of us. And the Admiral decided, really, there was more danger like that of having one of his escorts sunk than having the two escorts to protect him and doing his best to get along on two shafts. Now, while this was going on, QP-11, I think I've got the number right there, was attacked by three German destroyers. And the escort were extremely good, and they fought off these three German destroyers, who came back without doing any damage, came away without doing any damage, and then decided to have a look for the Edinburgh, who was a lame duck, and they thought she might be rather good game. And in fact, I think it was 36 hours after I'd joined up with the Edinburgh, these three German destroyers appeared at 6 o'clock one morning. Sorry. And, then we went to battle stations, of course. And Edinburgh was unable to do anything. We had three minesweepers turned up, which had come down to meet the Edinburgh, actually. And the Admiral told them to keep out of the way because he was afraid they'd simply be sunk because they were too small and hadn't got big enough guns. And otherwise, we took on the German destroyers. I personally am quite certain that we sank one of them. It is, the official history says the Edinburgh did. But the only gun the Edinburgh could use was B-turret. And the only way it could be controlled was by the captain leaning over the bridge and talking to the officer of the turret, who had his head sticking up through the hole at the back of the turret. And you can't get very accurate shooting like that. However, that's, I say, is my opinion. Because one of the German destroyers had to be sunk. She was hit. It was a hell of an explosion. And she was sunk by her own two consorts. And then they went away. Only they had succeeded in getting another torpedo into the Edinburgh, which was very sad. And the Edinburgh was then wallowing and in a very bad state. Both the Forester and the Foresight were quite badly damaged. And eventually I, the Foresight, was told by the Admiral to fire a coup de grace torpedo at the Edinburgh to sink her. I had one torpedo left and fired it and started a stopwatch to get the time when it should have hit her, and nothing happened. However, shortly afterwards, there was a hell of an explosion and the Edinburgh was sank. Her ship's company had been taken off, all of them, who weren't damaged in the original explosion, in the original torpedoing, were taken off by the minesweepers.
How far away from the Edinburgh were you when you launched the coup de grace?
I should think about 500 yards, something, not very far. But it was absolutely vital it should hit, because the Forester hadn't got any more torpedoes either. And we should never have sunk her by gunfire. Anyhow, she went down. It was all right. Thing I hadn't said was, the night before the German destroyers arrived, we had got two Russian destroyers with us. This was April the 30th, I think it was. And they said they had to go back to port for May Day, which they did. And they didn't send in reliefs out. We rather sucked our teeth over that, but what the truth was, I don't know. But they were quite definitely, we did have two Russian destroyers with us, and they shoved off.
Did you take any of the Edinburgh personnel aboard your ship?
No, I didn't. I got a little bit mixed when I talked about the Ju-88s and other aircraft coming at us, because that was on a second trip back, when after we had taken the Edinburgh, after we'd sunk the Edinburgh, because having sunk the Edinburgh, we went back, when I say we, Foresight, Forester, and four minesweepers, went back to Murmansk, and we had to mend it ourselves. And we then were told that if we could be repaired in time to escort the Trinidad, which had previously been damaged on her way to Murmansk, if we could be repaired in time to escort her back, we could go with her.
You said earlier that towing the Edinburgh proved to be no good.
Mm.
Why was that?
Well, it just wasn't. It's a matter of trial and error, you see. I mean, if you've got a fairly large ship which can only steer with a propeller by going faster on one than on the other, it's very difficult to get along on a straight course. And we thought that if we had a ship secured at the far end, at the rear end of the stern, you see, like that, that if she did start sharing, if I shared over, if the ship being towed shared over like that, it would bring her back, but it didn't work very well. And as I say, we tried it, and it worked after a fashion, but our speed of advance then was about 2 knots, I suppose. And as we had something like 200 miles to go, it's going to take a long time to get there.
What happened when you got back to Murmansk?
We joined up with the Trinidad, which had been damaged, as I say, on a previous convoy on her way out and was being repaired, And we, both Forsyth and Forrester, were taken into the Russian dockyard, and they managed us very efficiently there. And efficiently and quickly. And on that occasion, as a matter of fact, I remember they sent on board one of their dance parties. And I can't remember where we put them, because there was room somewhere. And they gave us a very good show of Russian dancing. And then after that, when the Trinidad was complete, we were told that we could go, her repairs were complete, we were told that we could go out with her. And just the Trinidad it was, no convoy at all. And so we did. And two fleet destroyers, the Matchless and the Somali, had been sent out as well, because Forsyth and Forrester were both, we hadn't got any torpedo tubes, we hadn't got many depth charges, and we were rather lame dogs. And it was then that we found ourselves under attack from Ju-88s and dive bombers, and we had the ice on the north side of us and the submarines below and all that sort of thing. And it really was rather an unpleasant time. Well, then, as a matter of fact, the last bomb to be dropped by one of the German destroyers, one German aircraft, hit the Trinidad, where she'd been hit already. And she started burning furiously. And the admiral, who had been in the Edinburgh, of course, Bonham Carter it was, decided the only thing to do was to abandon the ship. And so each of the four destroyers, Matchless, Somalia, Forsyth and Forrester, went alongside the Trinidad, and we each took off 200 sailors, 200 of the crew, which was the whole lot. And then the Matchless dispatched the Trinidad with a torpedo.
Did you actually see that?
Oh, yes, rather, yes. Certainly I did. But it was rather awful, two cruisers being lost within about a fortnight like that. Dreadful.
Now, going back to when you had the repairs done at Murmansk, can you describe in a bit more detail exactly what repairs were had to be carried out on the Foresight? Where was she damaged exactly?
There was a shell came through under the bridge, right through the side, and burst in the boiler room. And there was a shell came through just abaft my cabin, aft. Actually, it's all on the starboard side, because we were engaged on the starboard side. And I had about eight men killed. My first lieutenant was killed. And the captain of the Forrester was killed. They were hit in very much the same sort of way. And I always remember, after we got back to Murmansk, I was walking along the upper deck, and there were bits of my poor old chief stoker all over the after superstructure. He'd been just blown to smithereens, poor chap. Which was very rather frightful. But we only had one boiler, because the shell in the boiler room, and the Forrester was in very much the same way, so that we were really about sort of half power when we went back. And then we had to go back and refit straight away. We went to Hull.
Was the steering affected?
No, steering was not.
So what kind of repairs could be done? Just
virtually patching the side, making the ship's watertight. That's about all it was, but they did do it very well. I mean, there were damn great holes. We had stuffed them up with hammocks and things when we were going back to Murmansk, and that kept the water out. The weather was fairly good, fortunately, and they had to repair that. They didn't try and repair boilers or anything of that sort. They just made the ship seaworthy.
What about the hospital treatment that they got in Murmansk?
Absolutely dreadful. I had about three men in hospital there. One chap had lost an eye, and one or two others were in a bad way, and there was one boy, not one of mine, from a merchant ship, who had lost both his arms and both his legs from frostbite. The hospital itself was I only saw one room. It's an enormous great room, and it had people on stretchers, sort of stretcher beds, all over the floor. Very little space between them, and an appalling smell too. And I remember awfully well this young man of mine who lost an eye. I went and talked to him, and he said, I do hope you'll be able to take me home when you go. And I said, well, I'll do my best. And I did manage to get him, actually, and we took him back in the ship. Because they'd had a lot of treatment they had no anesthetics for, too, which is pretty uncomfortable, though. And as a matter of fact, I met this young man at a reunion dinner a matter of 5 or 6 years ago. And I was saying to him, of course, the one chap I remember very well who lost an eye, and I said I hoped I should get him back, and I did succeed. He said, it was me! It was the very chap. And he showed me his glass eye.
What was this smell? You mean of
decay? He was a steward, actually.
The smell you mentioned, was it a smell of decay?
It was, rather, yes. Mm.
Did they seem to be adequately staffed at the hospital?
I think so, yes. It was just horribly uncomfortable, and really and truly it was nothing like a hospital. I think they were doing their best, but they couldn't help it. They hadn't got the space, you see. I was thankful to get my people out. One chap had to stay behind. He had both his legs broken or something, and he couldn't get away. But I got the others away, all right.
What was the morale of this chap who'd lost all his limbs?
Seemed very good. He was a merchant service boy, actually. I suppose he was a boy of about 18, something like that. And he was very cheerful. How the hell he could be, I can't think, but he was. I felt so frightfully sorry for him. I mean, what would you do with no limbs at all? All by frostbite.
Was the foresight damaged on the second attempt to leave Murmansk?
No.
What kind of a ship was she to serve on? Was she a happy ship?
Yes, very. I was very happy in that. I think we all were, actually. I hated leaving her. And I've kept in touch with a number of people from the ship ever since then. And after I left her in 1942. So it's 44 years ago.
Were they regulars or hostility only?
Oh, both. We had quite a lot of hostilities only. One chap in particular was my steward, and he comes and stays with me occasionally. He was here last year. Very nice little man. And we get on very well.
How did the hostilities only and the regulars get on with each other?
Oh, perfectly well. I mean, there was no distinction at all. Absolutely none. I imagine on the lower deck they knew who were HOs, as we call them, or regulars. No, there was absolutely no distinction whatever, and they got on extremely well.
Not even in professionalism, in ability to do the job?
No. You see, we had an awful lot of you might call them hostilities-only officers, RNVR. And I remember when the war started, I used to rather look down my nose on RNVRs, but they were absolutely magnificent. I had a number of them right through the war. I had two or three in the foresight, and various other jobs I did afterwards, I mean, in command of destroyers and things. I had a lot of experience of them, and they were extremely good. I mean, just as good as we were. Probably better, I think. But, I was always terribly sorry when RNVR was abolished and turned into RNR. Because RNR, of course, were professionals, really, and RNVR were amateurs. And it's rather sad when the amateurs are turned into professionals on paper, I think. And I think a lot of them regretted it themselves very much, too. Doesn't make any difference, really, but I know. But
why do you think it's sad that the amateurs should become professionals?
Because they're not professionals. They only made professionals on paper. was it used to be volunteer reserve, and then it became reserve. All the RNR were merchant seamen. All the RNVR were yachtsmen and that sort. And you can't pretend really that a yachtsman is a professional, although he's jolly good.
Now, jumping ahead again to the early 50s, when the Korean War broke out, could you tell me how you were involved professionally in that?
I was captain of the cruiser Jamaica. And as a matter of fact, we've been doing various jobs. This is in the Far East. We've been doing various jobs. And I was sent up to a place called Ominato, which was in the north of Japan, and was to be to take the place of Wei Hai Wei, which between the wars was used as a sort of recreational place for the China fleet, for regattas and that sort of thing. And the idea was that Ominato should take its place. Well, on the way to Ominato, we were a party of, there was the Belfast, I think, flying the flag of Admiral, name's gone, sorry, Andrews, Admiral Andrews, and the Kenya, I think, and the Jamaica. And on the way there, the Korean War broke out. And so I in the Jamaica was detached to go and join up with the American forces on the east coast of Korea. It entailed going through a place called the Inland Sea, which is rather tricky navigation. And how we managed it all right, we anchored for the night and went on. And we arrived in Korea, and I joined up with an Admiral Higgins, H-I-G-G-I-N-S, in the cruiser Juno. He had with him one American destroyer and another British frigate, Black Swan, I think it was, came up and joined up, and we had a party of four. Well, we arrived off the Korean coast on a Saturday, and we started doing a bit of patrolling up more or less on the 38th parallel, which was the border between North and South Korea. And I was in my sea cabin. We were at sea. I was in my sea cabin on Sunday morning at about 6, and suddenly the officer watch whistled on the telephone that we were being attacked by some E-boats. Am I going too fast?
No, that's fine.
And indeed we were. And so we went to action. It was very unexpected, this was. We went to action stations very quickly.